Let's talk about Gilgamesh.
What?
I have racked my brain, why Gilgamesh? But before that, let's have a moment of comic relief. Comic relief. We leapt over Jung saying that when before we started the current section, he says he's talking about the horrors of birth, and he talks about being born between urine and feces. Well, here's the comic relief. Three engineering students were gathered together discussing who must design the human body. One said it was a mechanical engineer, just look at all the joints. Another said no, it was an electrical engineer. The nervous system has many thousands of electrical connections. Last one said no, actually, it had to have been a civil engineer. Who else would run a toxic waste pipeline through a recreational area?
You get that, put that on your website.
Oh. Or send that along with Gilgamesh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, Gilgamesh. Let's first have a quick look at the story of Gilgamesh. Then, Jung's interpretation of Gilgamesh and try to understand why it's this figure who appears. This was the plot overview I sent you on yesterday, I guess, maybe. It starts off the epic's prelude. If you don't have it, don't worry about it. I sent it to you and you can get it at your leisure. Well, here's the big thing. The Gilgamesh epic is probably from 3 to 4,000 BC. It's one of our oldest stories. In its earliest forms, it's thought to have originated in Sumeria, present-day Iraq. It was coalesced into more or less its current form in the Babylonian period of that area, around 2000 to 1500 BC. Later versions of it were found in the Assyrian Empire, which is later than that, I'm not sure. I think 1800 BC, but I'm not sure. Anyway, it's old. It's one of the oldest stories we've got. Probably that and the Osiris myth are the two oldest. One from Sumeria, one from Egypt. I think the very first detail of the myth gives us a clue why Jung chose it, or why Jung's unconscious chose it for him, one or the other, is that Gilgamesh was a cruel king. He was a despot. He took what he wanted, he raped whom he wanted, and he generally repressed all of those under him. Now, think about that as metaphor. Gilgamesh would represent the power ego that Jung had killed in Siegfried. Remember Siegfried? Mm-hmm. Where Siegfried means Sieg is victory, Fried is peace. But that Sieg is the same Sieg, I probably have said, that you see in the German movie Sieg Heil. It's on the surface, it means peace through victory. But really, that's just a cover. It really means victory. We dominate you. That's why it's peaceful. So it's a power image, Siegfried. It's who the Germans identified with in World War II. That's who Jung killed. So Siegfried means basically peace through domination. Just by his very name. Jung points out in the material I sent you today that Gilgamesh means the man of joy and sorrow. So he's a new type of hero who knows victory and defeat. I think that's...
So not a true Gil, not a true Siegfried.
Total
Siegfried.
No. And what I will be trying to show you, following on what Sandy was mentioning, I think this is the deeper meaning of the hero. It's the patriarchy that turns heroes into winners only. Prior to the patriarchy, heroes won and lost. This might be a point to follow a little ethnographic material. These rings, I'm just bringing along to show you where I think we can see how patriarchy changed the definition of hero, so that we get a feeling Jung is going back to the early definition of hero.
So Gilgamesh is prior to the patriarchy?
Well, I don't know if I could say he's prior to the patriarchy, but the matriarchy is still very strong. And because Ishtar plays a huge role. Now, he defeats her, but he is defeated in turn. He loses. The story of Gilgamesh is the story of a man who loses. What other Greek myth can you think where a hero gets the bejeebies beat out of him? But I just, this is sort of my opinion, but for what it's worth, just so you have a feeling for what is so important about Gilgamesh, that's why I'm going into this. This is a ring from Minoan Crete, about, I think, 1700 BC. It's a matriarchy. It's thought, of course we don't have any text from that point, but it's thought that it is a religious ritual in which the goddess as tree is torn down. The hero grieves the death of the goddess, and the goddess reappears as a dove. So it's about the death and rebirth of the goddess. That's the same thing as the dragon fight. The tearing down the tree would be parallel to Gilgamesh's killing the monsters. In all those early myths, the feminine is attacked and destroyed. But here, she is destroyed and she returns. And he's in a passive position, or a receptive position. Here's that's just a line drawing of the same thing. This is these are little rings. Do you have yours on, Sandy? They're small. Look how small they are.
That's actual size.
They wore them on their rings. This is the only one of the few texts, if we can call it that, that have remained from this period. And they were used to make stamps in clay.
And that must have been used for
stamps. And look how it's faded. Yeah.
Worn down.
So the hero is kneeling down there?
The hero, it's a little easier to see here. Now this is the ring, and then this is the impression it would have made. So the hero is kneeling, receiving the goddess after she's been killed. And this is probably a chrysalis, and this is a sheaf of wheat. And this is a storage vessel. Now look at that same ritual 200 years later, when the Indo-Europeans, who were patriarchs, usurped the Minoan culture and changed it to their own needs. Here is the tree being torn down. Here is the person receiving or being prepared to receive the goddess here, who returns not as a dove, but as a person. So they've taken that basic structure of the Minoans, and they've changed it to their own purposes. But there's a huge difference. So tearing down the tree, grieving and receiving the goddess. But look at the difference. This one's not kneeling anymore. Mm-hmm. So when the patriarchy comes in, that both the victory and the defeat of the hero becomes merely the victory of the hero. Gilgamesh still embodies that polarity of winning and losing. So I think that's one of the reasons why Gilgamesh comes. It's a new type of hero. And it is as relevant to us today as it was then. I don't think he'd mind me selling this, but when I was in Florida, John and Carolyn Mutz hosted me. And we went to see, I don't know if it's played here or not, there's a documentary on Churchill. Did it play here? Maybe not. It's very well done. About Churchill's coming to power, fighting Hitler, and the victory of the English over the Nazis. Churchill's a hero of mine. So the fact that he faced that darkness and won is impressive, I think. What they didn't tell in the movie is after the end of the war, after the victory over Hitler, Churchill was voted out of power. Mm-hmm. He was crushed. He had saved that nation, and they basically said, screw you. Mm-hmm. And he then went to northern Italy, where he painted, and sort of redefined himself and came back into public life. I don't know if he ever ran for political office or not. But John was annoyed with that. He said, you know, there are two types of heroes. There's the hero that wins, and there's the hero who recovers from a loss. And he would know about that. And I found that very meaningful and very moving. Originally, the hero was both of those things. But that movie stopped with Churchill's victory. But his real victory might have been that he didn't lose faith in his nation when they screwed him over. So again, Jung is going back to this wider understanding of what I would say true masculinity is. It can win and it can lose, and they both exist together as a polarity. And that is what heroism is. We still only recognize the hero as the winner.
That reminds me so much it seems like the same myth of Mary. When there's a church, the joy of all his sorrow, because she had loss of faith. You know, here's this thing that happened that she accepted, and she lost a lot of the collective values. And
Mater Dela Rosa.
And it was both a victory and a defeat.
Right.
And, you know, very much so.
Yeah.
And that just paralleled that so much, it seems like. As the feminine hero.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that the church thing, huh? Is that the church thing?
Yeah, it's in the Delaware. And you're describing that new definition of hero.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah, and actually it's, I think you can say it's in the Christian tradition. I mean, after all, Christ does have a tough day. But then there's glory. And where's the sadness then? And here, he loses, and he ends his story losing. So that, I think it's just trying to bring into our awareness this deeper dimension of engaging in life, that it's both happy and sad, as his name means, joyful and sorrow, winning and losing. And so that's the shift that Jung is now making. And that's going to be part of what allows him to integrate this polarity between matter and spirit.
In that other one, that the Europeans who created, it's interesting that the the receiving the goddess.
Yeah.
The whole back is turned.
Then the back is turned, yeah.
To the goddess.
Yeah. Of course, I think it is here, too.
Yeah. He's turning around.
No, he's not. He's turning around to face her. Yeah. I just think it's that happened within 200 years. It's an astounding difference. And we are still, this is the birth of the Western tradition. We're seeing it right there. And half of masculine and feminine is excluded.
At one point, I remember the Mycenaeans, or the Mycenaeans, however you want to call them.
Yeah, this is Mycenaean.
Yeah.
Second one.
That's what happened. They took this form from the Minoans, who were into the goddess worship,
mm-hmm.
and just turned it to the patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then cut out half of the experience.
Right.
So Jung is not just working on his own psyche, he's reevaluating a decision made in Western civilization 3,000 years ago. That's why Gilgamesh, I believe. That's the collective significance of Gilgamesh. I think it's astounding. Now, I was going to spend about 2 minutes on this. I bet I spent about 5 hours trying to figure this thing out. This is so important because this is the first day. This is the new beginning. It's a new type of hero.
In that book that Von Faust wrote on Gilgamesh, did she write something?
No, I brought along Rivka Kluger has got one on Gilgamesh. Pass it around if you like.
Was somebody called Jacobson or something like that in the book?
Could be, I don't know.
It may not be just specifically Gilgamesh.
Oh, it could be.
Maybe she talked about it in the Grail.
Probably talk about it, yeah. ZC, it's so fundamental. And I really didn't understand how fundamental it was until I started comparing it, asking myself, why did Jung pick Gilgamesh, or why did the unconscious pick Gilgamesh? And I think that's where you see how fundamental it is. Let's go on, I'll tell you some more. So, Gilgamesh is a despot. The people pray to the gods. The gods say, Gilgamesh, this is not acceptable, and they send a man to do him in, Enkidu. By the way, another reason I think it's so important is, which I'll, for the sake of time, I won't go into, but these major steps in the story are accompanied by dreams. So that the hero and the adversary are guided by dreams. Another reason, I don't know of any other hero that whose entire story is guided by dreams, even up to the Greeks. So not only does he lose, he listens to his dreams. Well, hello, welcome to Jung psychology. So they fight, but they strike a truce, and they decide to be friends. They go fight a demon named Humbaba, and they win. Then Ishtar takes a fancy to Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh says, no thank you, dearie. The last 10 guys you slept with are dead. She got mad and had her father, imagine, send a bull to kill Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh whoops the bull's butt, cuts off the bull's phallus, and throws it in Ishtar's face. This did not please her. Enkidu then turns sick and dies. Gilgamesh is saddened at death, and I'm making a long story short, goes seeking the plant of immortality. He travels, and finally meets the Sumerian Noah called Utnapishtim. Utnapishtim's wife convinces Utnapishtim to tell Gilgamesh where the plant of immortality is. Gilgamesh gets it, goes for a swim, a snake comes along and steals it, and Gilgamesh comes home broken. So you see, it ends as a tragedy. So let's very briefly look at what Jung made of it. And this is the stuff I sent to you this morning. If you didn't get it, it'll be there when you get home. You can don't have to worry about writing everything down because it'll be in your inbox. This is from volume 18. Jung talks about Gilgamesh. Just a couple of things he says. He calls Gilgamesh the ultimate social climber because of his meanness as a king. Jung mentions that Gilgamesh dreamt before Enkidu appears that a star would come to him, a star from heaven would fall. He takes the dream to his mother, and his mother interprets that star as Enkidu and tells him that you will be having an adversary who's equal in your strength, become your friend. From then on, Enkidu has bad dreams. And Jung interprets that to say Enkidu knows of Gilgamesh's inflation and knows that the story is going to end badly. And Jung claims that Gilgamesh kind of bought Enkidu off. They're not really friends, but Gilgamesh, being a shrewd politician, made peace with Enkidu just so Enkidu would help him. And Jung's interpretation is, you see an ego that is really not concerned about the whole. His attitude towards Enkidu is the same as his attitude towards the town that he was king of. That's what sets the stage for Gilgamesh's ultimate demise. So that the story shows a man who's split between himself and Enkidu, and it never gets resolved.
You mean split as himself and Enkidu?
Right. That if you take Enkidu as an inner figure, because he really didn't truly befriend Enkidu, but used him, struck a deal and used him, that he has an inner division. And that's what gave the story its final bad twist. Plus his arrogance toward Ishtar.
I keep coming back to the fact that Gilgamesh is two-thirds god and one-third man. Mm-hmm. There you see the inflation right away.
Yeah.
And the split.
And the split. So this is the figure that's coming to you. And I would take it as an image now of Jung's own inflation, which is going to go through tough times until it becomes human. So the hero, even though he fights battles, he undergoes a terrific process of humiliation and humanization by the end of the story. He goes back not the same arrogant person that he started out to be, after he loses the plant. He's lost his friend, or what is probably as close a friend as he could have. He lost Enkidu, and he lost the plant of immortality. So he goes back humbled. It's a complete different take on the hero as the one who wins. He's the one who loses, but grows to humanity through his losses. Now, apropos, we were talking about the snakes and the crocodiles. And I said the crocodile, I would take as the cold-blooded aspect of the self. Jung observes the real winner of the story is the snake. Well, that snake is the mother goddess. So that the story shows the ego cannot subdue the cold-blooded aspect of the self. Cold-blooded aspect of the self, the crocodile or the snake, would be what you have to do in life, whether you like it or not. Now, if you've got talent or if you have an assignment from the self, it doesn't care whether you were abused as a child. It doesn't care that you don't have money. It doesn't care about anything except that its intent gets done. That's the cold-blooded aspect of the self.
In that B book, she calls that the golden burden. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. The golden burden, exactly. It's a offer and a gift, but it's also a responsibility.
Pardon?
Her
first name is First, and I can't tell you her last name right off the top of my head, but she's an analyst from Australia.
So the other material I sent you is some of Jung's comments in Volume 5 on Gilgamesh. Now, I'll just touch on a couple of them. He points out there how Gilgamesh is, what I said earlier, split off from his own unconscious. Enkidu was a nature man, and his little trick in befriending him sets him up to represent an ego which is out of touch with the self, out of touch with the instincts.
So you say Gilgamesh is split off from the unconscious?
Right. And his defeats, you see, bring him closer in touch with who he is. It's his defeats that lead him toward fulfillment, not just his victories. He has victories too, but his story is a mixture of winning over the bull, winning over Enkidu at the very beginning. Winning over the bull, winning over the monster, winning over Enkidu at the beginning, but at the same time losing his friend and losing the plan. And both work together to bring him to who he is.
Interesting. Serpent is the one who keeps him mortal.
Keeps him human, you could say, too.
Human.
Yeah. It's a fantastic story when you really go into it like that. How all the stories we hear about heroes chopping off heads of people, here the hero gets a few of his heads chopped off and exists in a tension with his victories and his losses. So that's why Gilgamesh, I think. He is a hero that wins and loses. He's a hero that follows his dreams. And he represents an understanding of heroism. Remember, we just talked about ideals. He represents an understanding of heroism that is deeper than the concept of hero, which was established through patriarchal Greece.
So the kind of heroism that was lost, you're saying?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just look at that movie where it stopped with Churchill's victory. Nothing about his loss.
That's too bad. We'll do another one, but I'm really interested in whether he went back to government at all.
I don't remember. I think he did. I think he ran again.
He ran as prime minister.
And he won, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he did.
But he did have that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that guy, we'd be speaking German if it hadn't been for Churchill. Mm-hmm. And then, bye-bye. It must have just destroyed him.
Well, his paintings may have been his dreams.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if that's ever been published or made public or what he worked on, but... You can, huh?
But,
I thought they were mostly landscapes then. Why did they go to that one?
I don't know the full story.
I thought that maybe it was like, one.
There's a biography, really good biography that I read years ago, but I can't remember who wrote it. It talks exactly about all this that happened in the possession.
The British mindset of why they rejected him. And, I thought he was really popular during the war. But
I think there was a faction of people trying to get him out before, and they wanted to give Hitler whatever that he wanted. They thought that was the way to keep war,
for them. I mean, that was very
right. Yeah, there was a whole group.
What's his name?
Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain. Yes. Yeah. I've brought peace in our time. You guys said that.
Oh yeah, I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, upstairs, downstairs, right now.
That was good.
Yeah.
Some believe that
they've done a revision. She's carrying on the maid, is based in her. It's carrying on now, so it's really good. Mm-hmm. She's older now, but she's reflecting.
When is it on?
The maid is on.
It's over, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's
something
over, it's finished,
that,
right?
Yeah, I think it's
finished.
The
king that abdicated, they really wanted to get him out of here because he wanted to align himself with it. So they just used the American divorcee as a ruse because they really wanted to get him out of here.
And it
really had nothing to do with her. They just thought he's trying to. He just ruffled feathers and thinking that would work.
But he wasn't as weak as he was depicted as.
Well, he seemed
like a real.
Oh, not the guy that took over in the king.
No, his brother.
I mean, that's just a theory. I mean, read that and some will deny it. That he really wanted to go with Hitler and give him what he wanted, and therefore they thought a more war. So, that's just not very, not everyone.
Are you ready for more?
Well,
yes.
Just a little aside.
Yes.
On volume 5, your handout.
Yes.
Jung says a very strange thing.
Let's look at it.
He doesn't announce that he's speaking of an inner factor. He says, in the middle of the first paragraph.
What page?
171.
Yeah.
Your handout. He says, just as the sun, by its own motion in accordance with its own inner law, climbs from morning till noon, crosses the median, and then goes downward by its own motion. I think that's very strange. Because he speaks of it as though it's the inner law of the sun itself, not of an image of the sun, but the sun itself.
Oh, well, I think he means.
But it's man's own inner law that makes.
Yeah, I think that's what he's driving at.
And then he makes that comparison just as man by his own inner law. So that makes it emphasize even more that he's talking about the real sun, which is very strange.
Well,
I feel like I'm in a dream when he says that. Says it that way.
Maybe.
You know?
It's kind of imaginative thinking.
It definitely does not display a boundary between dream and reality.
Right. That's where he was at that time. Anything else before we dive in? Well, I just wanted to spend time so you got a sense of the importance of this guy. And well, maybe we should look at, these are the, I don't know if there's much to say there or not. That's the historian's initial of the first day. But we probably have something to say.
Well, just a little one.
Okay, well, why don't you get started then?
Well, he's showing the big dipper and the little dipper.
Oh, right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the little dipper contains the pole star at the very end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's positioned this pole star in the center of this spiraling snake.
Hmm.
So the pole star.
I guess you are saying something about
it. So the pole star is in this constellation. You know, the pole star is symbolic of the self. And it's at the center of the spiral, which is, as we've said, the representing Sophia as the pattern of our fate, or the constellation of our fate. And so it seems to be talking about, you know, his fate through this process. And then he shows, I'm assuming that's Izdubar to the right, but that basket that was tiny above his head before.
Oh, uh-huh.
And the serpent comes out of it, and the pole star is now the head of the serpent, mm-hmm. whereas in potentiality it was the tail over here in the constellation of mm-hmm. Ursa Minor. And yet it seems to somehow...
It's really important, I think.
Somehow rise from this container that Izdubar bore with him in the first image.
Absolutely. I agree with you totally.
Which at that point was that greening tree.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that greening tree has mm-hmm. seemed to contain this serpent, which those trees do. They have their daimon is associated with those mm-hmm. trees, which is often a serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And that serpent carries the pole star as its head.
I agree totally. So that serpent would be the material principle, and the star would be the spirit that can come out of it.
That's the union.
There's the union.
Mm-hmm.
I think the snake would be the instincts, okay. The body, the earth, our desires for things on the earth, and the star would be the meaning that comes out of our living our desires, because they really do have a symbolic purpose or knowledge built into them.
And it's night, so we're getting away from the solar consciousness.
And it's night, yeah. But all what we've done up to now is to try to get that star coming out of the snake. Finally, it's happening. And it looks like then that Gilgamesh, Izdubar, will be the same thing as the attitude that allows the snake to come out of life.
He somehow bears it with him.
Bears it with him, and the snake's a crowned snake. It's got a crowned head.
Right.
So that's instinct and meaning are now being linked together. I think that is so important for you. Religion is not something separate. Boy, try to get that through people's heads. It's like banging on a concrete wall.
So is it as though Jung is taking up the thing that Izdubar could not complete?
Yeah. Or even in Izdubar's failures, he is somehow completing it. We have to see how Jung understands that.
But does Izdubar ever really value that dark aspect?
I don't know whether he consciously values it, but it's been a while since I've read the original story. But I believe he comes back to his village a new man, appreciative of what there is and not needing to...
What was it that Jung said about him? He wants to know what happens to man after death. He finally succeeds in evoking Enkidu's spirit, which comes up from a hole in the earth and gives Gilgamesh very melancholy information. With this, the epos ends. The ultimate victory is won by the cold-blooded animal. So, it seems like there is something there for Jung to
complete
that Enkidu, or that Gilgamesh
didn't
not
complete. Yeah.
But at the end of the first handout that you sent, that last paragraph when Gilgamesh returns to Uruk, he is empty-handed but reconciled at last to his mortality.
That's an interpretation from that author.
I would have to agree with you. Yeah.
Oh, really?
I would, you know, when one should really read the whole thing.
Okay.
It's not short. It's a booklet. I wonder, too, whether it was a saccharinized ending.
Okay.
And also,
like he appreciates the city, you know.
Yeah, but there are many different versions of it. You know, okay. That Babylonian version was then taken up by the Assyrians,
okay,
who ostensibly just put it in tablet form, but made changes along the way.
Okay. And just above that, last paragraph, it says that a snake steals a plant one night, that's the plant of immortality,
yeah,
while they are camping. As the serpent slithers away, it sheds its skin and becomes young again, which is very similar to this image,
mm-hmm,
in a way.
It is a rebirth.
It's a new snake, which is what do you mean?
Well,
snake?
It's old skin.
I mean, in this one, how is it a new snake?
Well,
has
I just
it gone from that egg-like
right
structure to
mm-hmm.
Oh, I see.
And you might say that what we see happening in the story is the events in the unconscious, not hooked up to the ego. Jung is going to try to hook him up to the ego so that what is happening in the story can be consciously realized. But Gilgamesh doesn't realize his own rebirth in the snake. Jung will try to understand what's that mean if we do realize our own rebirth in the snake through defeat. Remember Jung saying the victory for the self is a defeat for the ego. I think that's where this comes from. Anyone feels like reading Rivka Kluger's book, Be My Guest, and they can report it. I'm not sure she's got it either, but she's a little optimistic. But anyway, you can see how complicated it is and how rich it is that he chose Gilgamesh. Hopefully it was worth our spending some time to get a sense. Yeah,
In this figure on the right here, and you may have mentioned this, is the snake inside the man there? It looks like it's inside.
Let's go back to the previous picture. Is that the decoration that they showed on his shirt?
More like a scarlet.
Can we go back?
Yes.
Oh, to death?
Death?
Well, that's where I went. I'm sorry.
Let's go back to the dippers.
See if you see what's on you. I didn't know if you're looking at it, it looked like the snake is inside, you know.
Well, it's very much like the snake that was surrounding him, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like he's wearing it as a
snake. You mean the snake inside here, Jane?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, how you like the coming out of the basket, and then that's the top of his head, that's the basket, the white thing, the urn, or the basket. Okay, because that reminded me, like in visions, where if you put the head on, or sometimes an egg, you find the meaning to the inside, and it even looked like a snake in there, inside it was the black thing. It also looks like there's a serpent. Is it? Is that gold thing that's spiraling around?
Right.
It has a serpent head?
Right. That makes
yeah.
sense.
Okay.
And the head is here, huh? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or
I don't know.
I was thinking of that little crooked thing down there.
With the head.
Yeah.
I was torn about that. Yeah.
That felt like a tail to me.
It felt like a head to me. But I was torn back and forth. You know, it was very.
On the guy in the corner with the
in charge.
Yeah, I was thinking of projection and recollection, where that in the ghost story to take up an hour.
Snake was on the arm.
It was the rope.
Yeah, the snake-like thing. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, the snake. Is that alchemical? Those are the alchemical colors. It's talking about the white, red, orange.
I think that those yellow canaries are supposed to be gold.
And the, okay.
Because he's got faded gold paint. Like the stars were at one time bright gold paint, sparkly gold paint, but it's lost its color due to age.
Those colors are interesting, and then they're patched together all the way.
The mosaic, again, mm-hmm. bringing together of all the parts.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that is eight. There's eight pieces of that star.
Completeness. Well, that's probably a good stopping point. Let's see, I had you read part of First Day. Why don't you, I think, to where, 279.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you finish it? Goes over to 281. I don't think we'll get farther than that. To 281.
Second day.
Right before Second Day. Okay. We're speeding up a little bit, but we got some pictures in here, too, to talk about, so.
The pictures tell us a lot, really.
They really do. You guys are wonderful with it. I have a block when it comes to picture interpretation. So, everyone still alive?
Thanks for that.
I think it helps, yeah. Okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks, then.
No, I took a course at CTS, a full course from Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson, who also did the front one drill. But anyhow, he started out that course at Go-To-Ash.
Oh, did he?
And of course, from Babylon forward. So it really is interesting to see a certain interpreter, you know, towards Christianity or at least Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, it's got the flood in it. I think that's where the flood narrative is thought to come from.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's see.
I think our next one's late in May.
Oh, maybe we won't be here in 2 weeks. Maybe I won't be here in 2 weeks.
Well, 2 weeks.
But we knew it meant. Yeah, the next one, I think, is May 20.
Is it?
Something, yeah.
May 26th.
May 26th and June 2nd.
Yeah.
May 26th and June 2nd.
Not the
12th.
Okay.
No, not the 12th. I won't be here. I'll be in Idaho.
I guess we can look at
pictures
if we want.
Look at pictures if you want. So 4 weeks then, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So will we miss Wednesday also in 2 weeks?
No.
Yeah, you're
I'll be here. I think I just took that off because it's too much to do a Thursday and then a Friday and a Saturday.
Gotcha.
Okay. I'll actually be in town, but I'll take that day to rest a little bit.
Mm-hmm.